He seems to be working to a completely different agenda. Then I'll have to rewrite that agenda.
The book is where a book should be, said Mrs. Babakoff. In a bookshop,
Harry guessed. Mrs. Babakoff smiled.
But no ordinary bookshop. If you want to keep that secret, I'll understand, especially if its discovery is likely to bring even greater punishment on your husband. What greater punishment could there be? His last words as he handed me the book were, I've risked my life for this, and would happily sacrifice it to know it had been published so that the world, and more important, the Russian people, can finally be told the truth. So I only have one purpose left in life, Mr. Clifton, and that is to see Anatoly's book published, whatever the consequences. Otherwise, every sacrifice he's made will have been in vain.
She grasped his hand.
You'll find it in an antiquarian bookshop that specializes in foreign translations on the corner of Nevsky Prospect and Bolshaya Morskaya Street in Leningrad, she said,
continuing to grasp Harry's hand, like a lonely widow clinging to her only son.
It's on the top shelf in the farthest corner, between War and Peace in Spanish and Tess of the D'Urbervilles in French. But don't look for Uncle Joe, because I hid it in the dust jacket of a Portuguese translation of A Tale of Two Cities. I don't think too many Portuguese visit that shop.
Harry smiled.
And if it's still there, and I'm able to bring it back, are you happy for Mr. Ginsburg to publish it?
Anatoly would have been proud to be...
She stopped, smiled again and said,
Anatoly will be proud to be published by the same house as Harry Clifton.
Harry took an envelope from the inside pocket of his jacket and handed it to her. She opened it slowly and extracted the check. Harry watched to see her reaction, but she simply put the check back in the envelope and returned it to him.
But surely Anatoly would have wanted you to... Yes, he would,
she said quietly.
But it's not what I want. Can you imagine the pain he suffers every day? So until he is released, I do not care to live in any degree of comfort. You, of all people, must understand that.
They sat silently together in the little room, holding hands. As the shadows crept in, Harry realized there was no light. She was determined to share her husband's prison. She displayed such dignity that it was Harry who felt embarrassed. Finally, Mrs. Babakoff stood.
I've kept you far too long, Mr. Clifton. I will understand if you decide not to return to Russia, as you have much to lose. And if you do not, I make only one request. Please say nothing until I have found someone who is willing to carry out the task. Mrs. Babakoff, Harry said, if the book is still there, I will find it. I will bring it back, and it will be published.
She embraced him and said,
I will, of course, understand if you change your mind.
Harry felt both sad and exhilarated as he walked back down the 8 flights of stairs to the now deserted sidewalk. He had to walk for several blocks before he was able to hail a cab, and he didn't notice the man following him, dodging in and out of the shadows, and occasionally taking a surreptitious photograph.
Damn,
muttered Harry, as the train pulled out of Union Station and began its long journey back to New York. He had been so preoccupied with meeting Mrs. Babakoff, he'd quite forgotten to visit the Carnegie. Jessica would chastise him. Wrong tense. Jessica would have chastised him.
Lady Virginia Fenwick, 1970. Chapter 28.
I would like to open this meeting, said Adrian Sloane, by offering my heartiest congratulations to Major Fisher on being elected as a Member of Parliament.
Hear, hear,
said Desmond Mellor, patting the new MP on the back.
Thank you, said Fisher. May I say that I consider it an added bonus that it was Giles Barrington I defeated?
And if I have my way, said Sloane, he won't be the only Barrington who's about to suffer a loss. But first, I'm going to ask Desmond to tell us how his meeting with Arnold Hardcastle went.
Not well, to begin with, because he clearly wasn't interested in selling his mother's shares, even at the inflated price of £3.09. But when I told him that my first action as the majority shareholder would be to sack Adrian and remove him from the board, his whole attitude changed.
He took the bait, said Fisher.
Of course he did, said Sloane. He hates me as much as you hate Emma Clifton and Giles Barrington, perhaps even more.
That's not possible, said Lady Virginia.
But the clincher, said Mellor, was when I told him who I intended to appoint as chairman of Farthings in Adrian's place.
Mellor couldn't resist pausing for as long as he felt he could get away with, before saying,
Ross Buchanan.
But one phone call to Buchanan, and he'll know.
You've forgotten, Major, that Hardcastle signed a confidentiality agreement, so he won't be phoning anyone. And I'd love to see his face when he discovers that we're changing the name of the bank from Farthings to Sloane's.
Can he still change his mind if someone makes him a better offer for the shares?
Asked Lady Virginia.
It's too late, said Mellor. He's already signed the share transfer certificates, so as long as I pay up within 21 days, the stock is mine.
And you'll only be out of pocket for a short time, said Sloane, before Hakeem Bishara buys the shares, giving you a handsome profit.
But if Bishara doesn't pay up, we'll all be left in the lurch,
Virginia reminded them.
He's been on the phone twice a day wanting updates on everything that's going on. He even postponed a visit to Beirut for a meeting with the Lebanese president. In fact, I'm thinking of upping the price from £5 to £6, but not until the last moment.
Isn't that a bit of a risk?
Asked Fisher.
Believe me, he's so desperate to get his hands on Farthings, he'll agree to almost anything.
Right, let's move on to the second part of our plan, which involves you, Lady Virginia, and the timing of your trial, which is crucial.
Emma Clifton will be served with pleadings next week, and my lawyers have told me they anticipate the trial will begin sometime in November.
That couldn't be better, said Mellor, checking his diary, because the next Barrington's board meeting is in 3 weeks' time, and I'll insist that Mrs. Clifton stands down as chairman for the good of the company, at least until the trial is over.
And there are no prizes for guessing who will take her place during that time, said Sloane.
Once I'm in the chair, said Mellor, I will consider it nothing less than my fiduciary duty to let the shareholders know what really happened on the first night of the Buckingham's maiden voyage.
But that's always been shrouded in mystery,
said Fisher, looking a little uneasy.
Not for much longer, it won't be. When I first joined the board of Barrington's, Jim Knowles hinted that all had not gone well on that voyage, but however much I pressed him, he wouldn't elaborate. Of course, I checked the minutes of the board meeting that was held on the ship later that morning, but all I could find was an apology from the captain for an explosion that took place in the early hours, which he blamed on the home fleet, who he claimed were carrying out night exercises in the North Atlantic. One look at the Admiralty records, and you'll quickly discover that the home fleet was anchored off Gibraltar at the time.
So what really happened?
Asked Fisher.
Because I tried to get the truth out of Knowles myself, and even after a few drams, he remained tight-lipped.
The only thing I could find out, said Mellor, was that he and the other board members had signed a confidentiality agreement. I thought I'd come to a dead end until last month's board meeting, when Mrs. Clifton made a rash decision without realizing its potential consequences.
No one asked the obvious question.
The Buckingham's captain had reported to the board that during its latest voyage, the third officer, a Mr. Jessel, was found drunk while serving on the bridge, and had been confined to his quarters for the rest of the crossing. Admiral Summers demanded that Jessel be sacked immediately without severance pay or a reference. I supported him because, like all the other board members, he'd forgotten that Jessel was the junior flag officer of the watch on the first night of the maiden voyage and must have witnessed everything that took place. Fisher dabbed his forehead with a handkerchief. It wasn't difficult, continued Meller, to track down Jessel, who is not only out of work, but admitted to being 3 months behind with his rent. I took him off to the local pub, and it didn't take long to discover that he was still angry and bitter about his dismissal. He went on to claim that he knew things that would bring the company down. A few rums later, and he began to elaborate on what those things were, assuming that I'd been sent to make sure he kept his mouth shut, which only made him open it even more. He told me that he saw Harry Clifton and Giles Barrington carrying a large vase of flowers up from one of the first-class cabins to the upper deck. They managed to throw it overboard just moments before it exploded. The following morning, three Irishmen were arrested, and the captain apologized to the passengers, giving them the home fleet story, whereas in truth, they were only seconds away from a major disaster that could have killed heaven knows how many people and, quite literally, sunk the company without trace.
But why didn't the IRA publicize what really happened?
Demanded Fisher nervously. Jessel told me that the three Irishmen were arrested later that morning and transported back to Belfast on a Royal Navy ship before being locked up in a Belfast prison on other charges. They've recently been released, and one of their bail conditions is that if they say a word about the Buckingham, they'll be back in solitary the same day. And let's face it, the IRA don't talk a lot about their failures.
But if the IRA are in no position to corroborate the story, and our only witness is a drunk who was dismissed from his post, why would anyone be interested nearly 6 years later? Asked Fisher. And how often, he added, have we read headlines claiming the IRA plan to bomb Buckingham Palace, the Bank of England, or the House of Commons?
I agree with you, Major, said Meller. But the press may take a very different attitude when, as the new chairman of Barrington's, I decide to put the record straight just weeks before the launch of the Balmoral and the announcement of the date of its maiden voyage.
But the share price would collapse overnight.
And we'll pick them up for almost nothing with the profit we make on the bank deal. With a new board in place and a change of name, we'll soon get the company back to its former status.
A change of name? Queried Lady Virginia.
Desmond smiled. Meller Shipping. Adrian gets the bank, and I get a shipping company.
And what do I get? Said Virginia.
Exactly what you always wanted, Virginia. The pleasure of bringing the Barrington family to their knees. And you still have a vital role to play, because timing will be everything. Another piece of information I picked up at the last board meeting was that Harry and Emma Clifton will be visiting New York next month, which, as chairman, she does every year. That will be the perfect time for you to let your friends in the press know what they can look forward to at the trial. It's important that you get your side of the story over while she's stuck in the middle of the Atlantic. So by the time Mrs. Clifton returns, she'll have to defend herself on two fronts. The shareholders will want to know why, as chairman of a public company, she failed to let them know what really happened that night. And at the same time, she'll be having to deal with Virginia's libel case. I predict it won't be long before she joins her father as a footnote in the company's history.
One snag, said Virginia. My lawyers only give me a 50-50 chance of winning the case.
By the time the trial opens, said Sloane, Emma Clifton will have lost whatever credibility she ever had. The jury will be on your side from the moment you enter the witness box.
But if I don't win, I'll end up with a hefty legal bill, persisted Virginia.
After Mrs. Clifton resigns as chairman of Barrington's, I can't see how you lose the case. But in that unlikely eventuality, the bank will happily cover all your costs. Pennies in the grand scheme of things.
That doesn't solve the problem of Sebastian Clifton and his 6%,
chipped in Major Fisher, because if he gets a place on the board, he'll know everything we...
I've got that covered, said Sloane. I'm going to call Clifton and suggest we meet.
Perhaps he'll refuse to see you.
He won't be able to resist. And when I offer him £5 a share for his stock, giving him 100% profit, he'll roll over. From what I remember of that boy, he forgets any other commitments the moment he sees a chance to make a killing.
But if he were to turn down your offer, said Fisher.
Then it's plan B, said Sloane. I don't care either way.
As I explained when we first met, Lady Virginia, in my professional opinion, your chances of winning this case are no better than 50-50, so perhaps it might be wise to drop the action. Thank you for your advice, Sir Edward, but it's a risk I'm willing to take.
So be it, replied her silk. But I felt it necessary to place my opinion on the record, so there can be no misunderstanding at a late date.
You've made your position abundantly clear, Sir Edward.
Then let's begin by looking at the facts of the case as objectively as we can. You either did or did not sell and later buy back a large number of Barrington shares with the sole purpose of harming the company.
Why would I want to harm the company?
Why, indeed? I should mention at this juncture that it will be the other side's responsibility to prove that you did, and not ours to prove that you didn't. Nevertheless, on three separate occasions, which coincided with the company having to announce bad news, you sold shares at their peak, and then 10 days later, when they had fallen in price, you returned to the market and repurchased them. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, but I only did so after taking Major Fisher's advice.
I think you should avoid mentioning Major Fisher when you're in the witness box.
But he's a Member of Parliament.
Perhaps this is the time to remind you, Lady Virginia, that lawyers, estate agents, and MPs are only just behind tax collectors in the opinion of most jurors.
But why shouldn't I mention it, when it's the truth?
Because Major Fisher was a director of Barrington's at the time you sold and repurchased the shares, and as he was your representative on the board, the jury won't be in any doubt where you were getting your information from. With that in mind, I should be advising you not to call Major Fisher, although it might be wise for you to alert him to the possibility of his being called by opposing counsel. If I were them, I would subpoena him.
Virginia looked anxious for the first time.
And then at a later date, continued Sir Edward, you purchased a large holding in Barrington's in order to take your place on the board, at a time when the company was selecting a new chairman.
Yes, Major Fisher was my choice to chair the board.
That's something else I must advise you against mentioning in the witness box.
But why? I thought Major Fisher would make a better chairman.
Possibly, but a jury of 12 ordinary citizens selected at random may well feel you were pursuing a vendetta against Mrs. Clifton, which would suggest that your original purpose in buying and selling the shares was indeed to harm her and the company.
I simply wanted the best qualified person as chairman. In any case, I still don't think a woman is capable of doing the job.
Lady Virginia, try to remember that it's likely half the jury will be women, and such an observation will not exactly endear you to them.
This is beginning to sound more like a beauty contest than a trial.
If you think along those lines, Lady Virginia, you won't go far wrong. Now, we must also assume that the other side will call your former husband, Sir Giles Barrington, as a witness.
Why? He wasn't involved in any way.
Except that all these transactions took place after your divorce, and your choice for chairman just happened to be the man who twice stood against him at general elections, which the jury may feel is one coincidence too many.
But even if they did call Giles, how can he possibly help their cause? He's an ex-husband, an ex-MP, and an ex-minister.
He hasn't exactly got a lot going for him. All that may well be true, said Sir Edward, but I have a feeling he would still impress the jury.
What makes you say that?
He has a great deal of experience as a public speaker, and the dispatch box prepares one well for the witness box, so we can't afford to underestimate him.
But the man's a loser,
said Virginia, unable to control her feelings.
I must stress that any personal attacks on the other side will play into their hands, so please remember to remain calm when you're giving evidence, and play to your strengths. You are the injured party, someone who doesn't understand the ways of the city, and who wouldn't have the first idea how to bring a company down.
But that will make me appear weak.
No, said Sir Edward firmly, that will make you appear vulnerable, which will work in your favour when the jury see you're up against a shrewd, tough businesswoman.
Whose side are you on?
I'm on your side, Lady Virginia, but it is my responsibility to be absolutely sure that you know what you're up against. With that in mind, I must ask you once again, are you certain you want to go ahead with this case?
Yes, I most certainly am, because there's one piece of evidence that I haven't told you about, Sir Edward, and once it becomes public, I don't think this case will ever get to court.
Chapter 29
Mr. Sloane called while you were at lunch,
said Rachel.
Did he say what he wanted?
Asked Seb.
No, other than that it was a personal matter.
I'm sure it is. He's worked out that I've got nearly 6% of Farthing's stock, so it's suddenly very personal.
He suggested you meet at his office at 11 tomorrow. There's space in your diary.
Forget it. If he wants to see me, he can damn well come here. I'll ring and find out if that's convenient.
I have a feeling it will be, because this time I'm in the driving seat.
Rachel didn't comment, and turned to leave the room.
You're not convinced, are you, Rachel?
Said Seb, before she reached the door. She turned back, but before she could offer an opinion, he asked,
What would Cedric have done?
He would have given Sloane the impression that he was falling in with his plans, so he would lower his guard.
Would he? Said Seb.
Then tell Sloane to expect me at 11 tomorrow morning. And add how much I'm looking forward to seeing him.
No, that would be overdoing it, but don't be late.
Why not?
Gives him back the advantage.
Giles wasn't looking forward to returning to the House of Commons for the first time since he'd lost his seat. The policeman at the St. Stephen's entrance saluted him.
Nice to see you, sir. Hope it won't be long before you're back.
Thank you.
Said Giles, as he walked into the building, past Westminster Hall, and along the corridor where members of the public wait patiently, hoping to be allocated a seat in the Strangers' Gallery so they can follow the business of the day. Giles marched on past them into Central Lobby, walking briskly so as not to be held up by former colleagues offering their commiserations and adding platitudes they rarely meant. Passing another policeman, he stepped onto the thick green carpet he'd trodden for so many years. He glanced at the ticker tape machine that kept members up to date with what was happening around the world, but didn't stop to check the latest headline. On past the members' library, dreading he might bump into one particular member he didn't want to see. He took a left when he reached the office of the Leader of the House and came to a halt outside a room he hadn't entered for years. He knocked on the door of Her Majesty's Leader of the Opposition, and walked in to find seated at their desks the same two secretaries who had served the former Prime Minister when he was in Downing Street.
Nice to see you again, Sir Giles. You can go straight in. Mr. Wilson is expecting you.
Another knock on another door, and he entered the room to see the familiar sight of a man attempting to light his pipe. He gave up when he saw Giles.
Giles, I've been looking forward to this all day. It's good to see you.
And it's good to see you, Harold,
responded Giles, not shaking hands with his colleague in the Palace of Westminster, maintaining a tradition that had been upheld for centuries.
"Such bad luck to lose by only 21 votes," said Wilson. "I can't pretend I care much for your successor."
"This place will find him out," said Giles. "It always does."
"And how are you coping with the post-election blues?"
"Not that well. I'm bound to admit I miss the place."
"I was sorry to hear about you and Gwyneth. I hope you'll find it possible to remain friends."
"I hope so too, because I'm to blame.
I'm afraid we began to drift apart some time ago."
"This place doesn't help," said Harold. "You need a very understanding wife when you're rarely home before 10 o'clock most nights."
"And what about you, Harold? How are you taking to being leader of the opposition again?"
"Not you. Not that well. So, tell me, what's it like out there in the real world?"
"I'm not enjoying it, and I won't pretend otherwise. When you've been in politics for a quarter of a century, you're not really qualified to do much else."
"Then why don't we do something about it?"
said Wilson, finally managing to light his pipe.
"I need a front bench spokesman on foreign affairs in the House of Lords, and I can't think of a better person for the job."
"I'm flattered, Harold, and I thought that might be the reason you wanted to see me. I've given it a great deal of thought, and I wondered if I might ask you a question before I make a decision."
"Of course."
"I don't think Ted Heath is proving to be any better in government than he was in opposition. The voters' view of him as the grocer rather sums it up. And more important, I'm convinced we still have an excellent chance of winning the next election."
"As my Jewish friends would say, from your lips to God's ears."
"And if I'm right, it won't be that long before you're back in number 10.
"Amen to that."
"And both of us know that the real power is in the Commons, not the Lords. Frankly, it's a deluxe old people's retirement home, a reward for party hacks with a record of long service and good conduct."
"With the possible exception of those who sit on the front bench and revise regulation," suggested Wilson.
"But I'm only 50, Harold, and I'm not sure I want to spend the rest of my life waiting to be called to an even higher place."
"I'd put you to work," said Wilson, "and you'd have a place in the Shadow Cabinet."
"I'm not sure that's enough, Harold. So I need to ask you, if I contested Bristol Docklands at the next election, and the local association is pressing me to do so, and you formed the next government, would I have a chance of becoming Foreign Secretary?"
Wilson puffed away on his pipe for a few moments, something he often did if he needed a little time to consider.
"No, not immediately, Giles. That wouldn't be fair on Dennis, who, as you know, is shadowing the post at the moment. But I can guarantee you will be offered a senior cabinet post, and if you did well, you'd be among the frontrunners if the job became available. Whereas if you took up my offer, at least you'd be back in the House. And if you're right and we win the election, it's no secret that I'd be looking for a leader of the Lords."
"I'm a Commons man, Harold, and I don't think I'm quite ready yet to be put out to grass. So it's a risk I'm willing to take."
"I salute your resolve," said Wilson. "And now it's my turn to thank you, because I know you wouldn't be willing to take that risk unless you believed not only that you can win back your seat, but that I have a good chance of returning to number 10. However, should you change your mind, just let me know, and then, like your grandfather, you'll be sitting on the red benches as Lord Barrington of
Bristol Docklands," said Giles.
Sebastian entered Farthing's Bank for the first time since he'd resigned 5 years before. He walked up to the reception desk and gave the duty clerk his name.
"Ah, yes, Mr. Clifton," the man said, checking his list. "The chairman is expecting you."
When he said "the chairman," Seb's immediate thought was of Cedric Hardcastle, and not of the usurper who'd been the reason he resigned.
Would you be kind enough to sign the visitor's book?
Seb took a pen from an inside pocket of his jacket and slowly unscrewed the cap, giving himself a little time to study the list of those who'd recently visited the chairman. His eye ran quickly down two columns of names, most of which meant nothing to him. But two of them might as well have had flashing neon lights next to them. Desmond Mellor, who Seb knew Sloane had recently appointed as deputy chairman, so that came as no surprise. But what possible reason could Major Alex Fisher, MP, have had for visiting the chairman of Farthing's? One thing was certain, Sloane wasn't going to tell him. The only other name that caught his eye was that of Hakeem Bishara. He was sure he'd read something about Mr. Bishara in the Financial Times recently, but couldn't remember what.
"The chairman will see you now, sir. His office is on the top floor," said Seb. "Many thanks."
When Seb stepped out of the lift on the executive floor, he walked slowly down the corridor towards Cedric's old office. He recognised no one, and no one recognised him. But then he knew Sloane hadn't wasted any time in purging Farthing's of all Cedric's lieutenants. He didn't have to knock on Sloane's door because it swung open when he was a couple of paces away.
"Good to see you, Seb," said Sloane.
"It's been too long," he added, before he ushered him into his office, but didn't risk offering to shake his hand. The first thing that struck Seb as he entered the chairman's office was that there was no sign of Cedric. No acknowledgement of his 30 years' stewardship of the bank, no portrait, no photograph, no plaque to remind the next generation of his achievements. Sloane had not only replaced him, but had airbrushed him out of existence, like a Soviet politician who'd fallen from favour.
"Have a seat," said Sloane, as if he was addressing one of the bank's junior clerks.
Seb took a closer look at his adversary. He put on a few pounds since they'd last met, but it was cleverly masked by a well-tailored double-breasted suit. One thing that hadn't changed was the insincere smile of a man most people in the city were reluctant to do business with. Sloane took his seat behind the chairman's desk and didn't waste any more time with banalities.
"Seb, someone as bright as you will already have worked out why I wanted to see you."
"I assumed you were going to offer me a place on the board of Farthing's."
"That's not exactly what I had in mind."
The false laugh followed, to accompany the insincere smile.
"However, it's been clear for some time that you've been buying the bank's stock on the open market, and you now only need another 22,000 shares to cross the threshold that would allow you to automatically take a place on the board or to nominate someone else to represent you."
"Be assured, I'll be representing myself."
"Which is why I wanted to talk to you. It's no secret that we didn't get on well when you worked under me,
which is why I resigned.
It's also why I feel it would be inappropriate for you to be involved in the day-to-day running of the bank."
"I have absolutely no interest in the day-to-day running of the bank. I assume you have capable staff to carry out that job. That was never my intention."
"Then what is your intention?" demanded Sloane, barely able to hide his irritation.
"To play a role in ensuring that this bank returns to the high standards it enjoyed under your predecessor, and to be sure that the shareholders are kept informed of what goes on in their name."
Seb decided to roll a small hand grenade across the table and see if it exploded when it reached the other side.
"Because it's clear to me, after reading the minutes of past board meetings, that you are not telling stockholders the whole story."
"What do you mean by that?" asked Sloane, a little too quickly.
"I think you know all too well what I mean."
"Perhaps we can make a deal. After all, you always were a brilliant dealer."
From bully to flatterer, with hardly a moment's pause in between. Morris Swan would have cast Sloane as Richard III, and he could have played it without a script.
"What sort of deal do you have in mind?" asked Seb.
"Over the past 5 years, you must have paid an average of around £2.10 per share. I'm prepared to double that and offer you £5 a share, which I'm sure you'll agree is generous."
Far too generous, thought Seb. £3 should have been his opening bid, and £4 his closing. Why was Sloane so keen to keep him off the board?
More than generous, Seb replied. But I still intend to take my place on the board. You see, with me, it's personal.
Then I shall have to make an official complaint to the Bank of England, pointing out that you have no interest in supporting the bank's long-term aims.
Frankly, I'm only interested in finding out what Farthing's long-term aims are, which is why I visited the Bank of England last week and had a long chat with Mr. Craig, the Chief Compliance Officer. He was kind enough to check the bank's statutes and has confirmed in writing that as long as I have a stock holding of 6%, I'm entitled to a place on the board. But do, by all means, give him a call. If Sloane had been a dragon, flames would have been belching out of his nostrils. And if I were to offer you £10 a share? Sloane was clearly out of control, so Seb decided to lob a second grenade. Then I begin to think the rumours were true.
What rumours? Demanded Sloane.
Did he dare risk taking another pin out?
Why don't you ask Desmond Mellor and Alex Fisher what they've been up to behind your back?
How did you know?
The hand grenade had exploded in Sloane's face, but Seb couldn't resist one more sortie.
You have a lot of enemies in the square mile, Sloane, and even one or two in your own office.
It's time for you to leave, Clifton.
Yes, I'm sure you're right.
But I look forward to seeing you and your colleagues at next month's board meeting.
I have so many questions for them, particularly for Mr. Mellor, who seems quite happy to open the batting for both teams.
Sloane didn't move, but the flush in his cheeks showed another hand grenade had exploded. Seb smiled for the first time, rose from his place, and turned to leave, when Sloane lobbed his own hand grenade.
I fear I won't be seeing you again for some time, Sebastian.
Why not? Demanded Seb, swinging round.
Because at the last board meeting we passed a resolution stating that any outsider who wished to join the board in future will be required to own 10% of the company's stock.
You can't do that, said Seb defiantly.
I can, and I have, said Sloane. And I feel sure you'll be pleased to hear that Mr. Craig, the Chief Compliance Officer at the Bank of England, has given our unanimous resolution his blessing. So I'll see you in about 5 years' time. But don't hold your breath, Seb, because if you did get hold of 10%, we would just have to pass another resolution.
Chapter 30.
How long do you think you'll be in Russia?
Giles asked Harry as he rose from the dining table and led his guests through to the drawing room for coffee.
Just a few hours, at most overnight.
What takes you back there?
No one visits that place a second time without a damn good reason.
I'm going shopping.
Paris, Rome, New York, said Giles. But no one goes shopping in Russia, other than the locals.
Unless there's something they have in Russia you can't buy in Paris, Rome, or New York,
suggested Emma, as she poured her brother a coffee.
Ah, how slow of me. I should have remembered that Harry's just returned from the States, and Harold Ginsberg wasn't the only person he visited. That's a clue Inspector Warwick wouldn't have missed.
I would have put off the trip until after Emma's trial, said Harry, ignoring Giles's deduction. But my visa runs out in a couple of weeks, and the Russian embassies warn me there could be a 6-month delay before they issue me with a new one.
Just be careful, said Giles.
The Russians may have their own Inspector Warwick, who could be sitting waiting for you.
After his own experience in East Berlin, Giles doubted if Harry would get beyond customs, but he accepted there was no way he could ever hope to dissuade his brother-in-law once he'd made up his mind.
I'll be in and out before they realize it, said Harry. So there's nothing for you to be anxious about. In fact, I'm far more worried about the problems Emma's facing.
What in particular?
Asked Giles as he handed Harry a brandy.
Desmond Mellor is standing for deputy chairman at next month's board meeting, said Emma.
Are you telling me that charlatan's found two directors who are willing to propose and second him? Said Giles.
Yes, his old friend Jim Knowles, assisted by his even older friend Clive Anscott.
But if they fail to get him elected, said Giles, surely all three of them will have to resign. So this could turn out to be a blessing in disguise.
Not much of a blessing if they do get him elected, said Harry.
Why, what's the worst Mellor can do, even if he does become deputy chairman? Said Giles.
He could suggest that I stand down until the trial is over, said Emma, for the good of the company.
And then the deputy chairman would become acting chairman. But only for a few weeks, said Harry. You'd return once the trial was over.
You can't afford to give Mellor that much rope, said Giles. Once you're no longer able to attend board meetings, he'll find a way of making temporary become permanent, believe me.
But you could refuse to stand down, Emma, even if he does become your deputy, suggested Harry.
I won't be given a lot of choice if I have to spend the best part of a month stuck in the High Court defending myself.
But once you win, said Giles, if I win.
I can't wait to get in the witness box and tell the jury some home truths about Virginia.
We won't be calling you, Giles, said Emma quietly.
But I know more about Virginia than...
That's exactly what my barrister is worried about. After a few well-chosen words from her ex-husband, the jury might even end up feeling sorry for her. And Mr. Trelford, my barrister, says Sir Edward Makepeace, her silk, won't be shy about raising the subject of your second divorce and what caused it.
So who are you going to call?
Major Alex Fisher, MP.
But won't he be a defence witness?
Mr. Trelford doesn't think so. Fisher could well be as much of a liability for them as you might be for us.
Then perhaps the other side will call me, said Giles, sounding hopeful.
Let's hope not.
I pay good money to see Fisher in the witness box, said Giles, ignoring his sister's barb. Remind Mr. Trelford that he's got a very short fuse, especially if he's not treated with the respect he feels he deserves. And that was true even before he became an MP.
The same can be said of Virginia, said Harry. She won't be able to resist reminding everyone that she's the daughter of an earl, and there won't be too many of those on the jury.
However, said Giles, it would be equally foolish to underestimate Sir Edward. If I may quote Trollope when describing another advocate, he is as bright as a diamond and as cutting, and also as unimpressionable. And I may need those same qualities at next month's board meeting when I climb into the ring with Mellor.
I have a feeling that Mellor and Virginia must be working together, said Giles. The timing's just a little too convenient.
Not to mention Fisher, added Harry.
Have you decided yet if you're going to stand against him at the next election? Asked Emma.
Perhaps it's time to tell you that Harold Wilson has offered me a seat in the Lords.
Congratulations, said Emma, leaping up from her chair and throwing her arms around her brother. Some good news at last.
And I turned him down.
You did what?
I turned him down. I told him I wanted one more crack at Bristol Docklands.
And one more crack at Fisher, no doubt, said Harry.
That would be part of the reason, admitted Giles. But if he beats me again, I'll call it a day.
I think you're out of your mind, said Emma.
Which is exactly what you said when I first told you 25 years ago that I was going to stand for Parliament.
As a socialist, Emma reminded him.
If it makes you feel any better, said Giles, Sebastian agrees with you.
Does that mean you've seen him since he got back from New York? Asked Harry.
Yes, and before you ask, he clammed up the moment I raised the subject.
Pity, said Harry. Such a remarkable girl.
But what I can tell you is that when I dropped into his office before taking him out to lunch, I spotted a child's painting on the wall behind his desk that I'd never seen before. It was called My Mom, and I could have sworn it was Jessica's hand.
A painting of me? Asked Emma.
No, That's the strange thing, said Giles. It was of Samantha.
Sloan offered you £10 a share, said Ross Buchanan. But that doesn't make any sense. Farthings are trading at £2.08 this morning.
He was simply trying to find out what my limit was, said Seb. Once he realized I wasn't interested, he threw in the towel and lost his temper.
That shouldn't have come as a surprise. But why is he so desperate to get his hands on your 6%?
And where do Mellor and Fisher fit in?
An unholy alliance is up to no good, that's for sure.
There was another name in the visitor's book that just might provide the answer. Have you ever come across someone called Hakim Bishara?
I've never met him, said Ross, but I attended a lecture he gave at the London School of Economics, and I was mightily impressed. He's Turkish, but was educated in Beirut. He came top in the entrance exam for Oxford, but they didn't offer him a place.
Why?
It was assumed he must have cheated. After all, how could a boy called Hakim Bishara, the son of a Turkish carpet trader and a Syrian prostitute, possibly beat the cream of the English public school system? So he went to Yale instead, and after he graduated, he won a scholarship to Harvard Business School, where he's now a visiting professor.
So he's an academic?
Far from it. Bishara practices what he preaches. When he was 29, he mounted an audacious coup to take over the Beirut Commerce and Trading Bank. It's now one of the most respected financial institutions in the Middle East.
So what's he doing in England?
For some time now, he's been trying to get the Bank of England to grant him a license to open a branch of BC&T in London. But so far, they've always turned him down.
Why?
The Bank of England doesn't have to give a reason, and don't forget, its committee is made up of the same breed of chinless wonders who prevented Bishara from going to Oxford. But he's not a man who gives up easily. I recently read in the Questor column of the Telegraph that he now intends to bypass the committee and take over an English bank. And what bank could be riper for takeover than Farthing's?
He was staring me in the face, and I didn't spot it, said Seb.
When you put two and two together, they usually make four, said Ross. But it still doesn't make a lot of sense to me because Bishara is happily married, a devout Muslim who's spent years building a reputation for scrupulous honesty and straight dealing, not unlike Cedric. So why would he be willing to deal with Sloane, who's built a reputation for being unscrupulous and dishonest, and deals from the bottom of the pile?
There's only one way I'm going to find out, said Seb, and that's to meet him. Any ideas?
Not unless you're a world-class backgammon player, because that's his hobby.
I know what to do with a 6 and a 1 on the opening throw, but not much more.
Well, whenever he's in London, he plays regularly at the Clermont Club. He's part of the Clermont set. Goldsmith, Aspinall, Lucan. Loners like him, who don't fit easily into London society. But don't take him on, Seb, unless you want to lose the shirt off your back. Frankly, where Bishara is concerned, you don't have a lot going for you.
I've got one thing going for me, said Seb. We have something in common.
If I were a betting man, Mrs. Clifton, the answer to your question would be even money. But the one imponderable in any trial is how people perform once they're in the witness box.
Perform? But shouldn't one just be oneself and tell the truth?
Yes, of course, said Mr. Trelford. However, I don't want the jury to feel they are members of a committee that's being chaired by you.
But that's what I do, said Emma.
Not while you're in the witness box, you don't. I want all the men on the jury to fall in love with you, and, if possible, the judge as well.
And the women?
They must feel you had to struggle to achieve your amazing success.
Well, at least that's true. Do you think Sir Edward will be giving Virginia the same advice?
Undoubtedly. He'll want to portray her as a damsel in distress, lost in the cruel world of commerce and finance, and trodden on by a bully who's used to having her own way. But that couldn't be further from the truth. I think we'll have to leave the 12 jurors to decide what the truth is, Mrs. Clifton. But for now, let's look at the facts in the cold light of day. The first part of your response to Lady Virginia's question at a well-attended public meeting, and as recorded in the company's minutes, we will plead as justification. We will point out that Major Fisher was not only Lady Virginia's chosen vessel on the board, but that it was his inside knowledge as a director of the company that made it possible for her to buy and sell shares to her advantage. Sir Edward will find that hard to refute, and will pass over it as quickly as possible, and concentrate on what you added as she was leaving the hall. If it was your intention to bring the company down, Lady Virginia, then you have failed, and failed lamentably, because you were defeated by decent, ordinary people who want the company to be a success. Decent, ordinary people is our problem, because that's how the jury will see themselves. And Sir Edward will claim that not only is his client a decent, ordinary person, but that the reason she continued to buy Barrington shares was that she had faith in the company, and the last thing she would have wanted was to bring it down.
But every time Virginia sold her shares, she made a vast profit and put the stability of the company at risk.
Indeed, that may well be the case, and I'm hoping that Lady Virginia will attempt to present herself as an innocent when it comes to business matters, and try to persuade the jury that all along she was relying on the expertise of her professional adviser, Major Alexander Fisher.
But they were working as a team to bring the company down.
Quite possibly. But when she's in the witness box, Sir Edward will ask Lady Virginia the one question you avoided answering. Who were you referring to, Lady Virginia, when you said?
Mr. Trelford pushed his half-moon spectacles up his nose and checked the exact words.
Is it true that one of your directors sold his vast shareholding over the weekend in an attempt to bring the company down?
But Cedric Hardcastle wasn't trying to bring the company down. The exact opposite. He was attempting to save it, as he would have explained himself, had he been able to take his place in the witness box.
I'll word this as delicately as I can in the circumstances, Mrs. Clifton, but I am relieved that the other side can't call Mr. Hardcastle, because we certainly wouldn't have.
But why not? When he was a thoroughly decent and honest man.
Of that I have no doubt. But Sir Edward will point out that Mr. Hardcastle was doing exactly the same thing as you are accusing Lady Virginia of,
with the intention of saving the company, not bringing it to its knees.
Possibly, but by then you will have lost both the argument and the case.
I still wish he were alive today,
said Emma.
Now, I need you to remember the way you delivered those words, Mrs. Clifton, because that's exactly how I want the jury to think of you when they are considering their verdict.
I'm not looking forward to this,
admitted Emma.
Then perhaps it might be wise for you to consider settling the action.
Why would I do that?
To avoid a high-profile trial, with all the attendant publicity, and to get back to your normal life.
But that would be admitting she was in the right.
Your statement would be worded carefully. The heat of the moment, possibly a little injudicious at the time, and we offer our sincere apologies.
And the financial implications?
You would have to pay her costs, my fees, and a small donation to the charity of her choice.
Believe me, said Emma, if we were to go down that road, Virginia would see it as a sign of weakness and would be even more determined to go ahead with the action. She doesn't want the case to go away quietly. She wants to be vindicated in court as well as in the press, preferably with headlines that will humiliate me day after day.
Possibly. But it will be Sir Edward's professional responsibility also to put the alternative to her, that if she loses the case, she will end up paying your costs as well as his. And I assure you, there's nothing cheap about Sir Edward Makepeace.
She'll ignore his advice. Virginia doesn't believe it's possible she might lose, and I can prove it.
Mr. Telford sat back and listened carefully to what his client had to say. When she had finished, he believed for the first time that they just might have a chance. Chapter 31. Sebastian got out of the car and handed the doorman his keys and a pound note. As he walked up the steps to the entrance of the Clermont, the door was opened for him, and he parted with a second.
"Are you a member, sir?"
asked the elegantly dressed man standing behind the front desk.
"No,"
said Seb, this time slipping the man a £5 note.
"Just sign here, sir,"
the man said, swivelling a form round. Seb signed where the finger rested and received a temporary membership card.
"The main gaming room is at the top of the stairs on your left, sir."
Seb walked up the sweeping marble staircase, admiring the dazzling chandelier, the oil paintings and the thick plush carpet. Millionaires must be made to feel at home, he concluded, otherwise they wouldn't be willing to part with their money. He entered the gaming room but didn't look round, as he wanted the onlookers to believe this was his natural habitat. He strolled across to the bar and climbed onto a leather stool.
"What can I get you, sir?"
asked the barman.
"A Campari and soda,"
said Seb, as this clearly wasn't a club that served draft ale. When the drink was placed in front of him, he took out his wallet and placed a pound on the bar.
"There's no charge, sir."
Establishments that don't charge for drinks have to be making up for the loss in some other ways, thought Seb, leaving the note where it lay.
"Thank you, sir,"
said the barman, as Seb swiveled round and slowly took in the some other ways. Two roulette tables stood next to each other on the far side of the room, and from the large pile of chips in front of each of the players and their expressionless faces, Seb assumed they were regulars. Hadn't anyone explained to them that they were paying for the marble staircase, the oil paintings, the chandelier, and the free drinks? His eyes moved on to the blackjack tables. At least there the odds were slightly better, because if you could count the court cards, it was even possible to beat the house. But only once, because after that, you'd never be allowed to darken the club's doors again. Casinos like winners, but not consistent ones. His gaze moved on to two men playing backgammon. One was sipping a black coffee, the other a brandy. Seb turned back to the barman.
"Is that Hakim Bishara playing backgammon?"
The barman looked up.
Yes, it is, sir."
Seb took a closer look at the short, pursy, red-cheeked man who looked as if he had to make regular visits to his tailor. He was bald, and his double chin suggested a greater interest in food and drink than weight training or running. A tall, lithe blonde stood by his side, a hand resting on his shoulder. Seb suspected she was less attracted by the deep lines on his forehead than by the thick wallet in his inside pocket. He wasn't surprised that he kept being rejected by the English establishment. His younger opponent looked like a lamb about to be devoured by a python. Seb turned back to the barman.
"How do I get a game with Bishara?"
"It's not that difficult if you've got £100 to throw away."
"He plays for money?"
"No, for amusement."
"But £100?
"It's an admission fee that you donate to his favourite charity."
"Any tips?"
"Yes, sir, you'd be better off giving me £50 and going home."
"But what if I beat him?"
"Then I'll give you £50 and I'll go home. Mind you, you'll enjoy his company for the few minutes the game lasts, and if you were to win, he'll donate £1,000 to the charity of your choice. He's a real gentleman."
Despite appearances, thought Seb, as he ordered a second drink. He occasionally glanced around at the backgammon table, but it was another 20 minutes before the barman whispered,
"He's free now, sir, waiting for his next victim."
Seb swung round to see the stout man heave himself out of his chair and begin to walk away with the young woman on his arm.
"But I thought..."
He looked more closely at the lamb that had devoured the python. He could hear Cedric saying,
"What did you learn from that, young man?"
Bishara looked around 40, perhaps a little older, but his tanned good looks and athletic build suggested that he wouldn't have to continually empty his wallet to attract a beautiful woman. He had thick, wavy black hair and dark, penetrating eyes. Had he been penniless, you might have thought he was an out-of-work actor. Seb slipped off the stool and walked slowly towards him, hoping he looked relaxed and in control, because he wasn't.
"Good evening, Mr. Bashara. I wondered if you were free for a game."
"Not free," he said, giving Seb a warm smile. "In fact, rather expensive."
"Yes, the barman warned me about your terms, but I still want to play you."
"Good. Then have a seat."
Bashara rolled one dice out onto the board. Seb was painfully aware after the first half a dozen moves that this man was quite simply in another class. It took only a few minutes before Bashara began removing his counters from the board.
"Tell me, Mr. Clifton.
Sebastian Clifton."
Bashara reset the board.
"As you are clearly not even a respectable pub player, you must have had a good reason for wanting to give away £100.
"Yes, I did," said Seb, taking out his checkbook. "I needed an excuse to meet you."
"And why, may I ask?"
"Because we have several things in common, one in particular."
"Clearly not backgammon."
"True," said Seb. "Who should I make the check out to?"
"The Polio Society." "You haven't answered my question."
"I thought we might trade information."
"What makes you think you have any information I might be interested in?"
"Because I saw your name in a visitor's book and thought you just might like to know that I own 6% of Farthing's Bank."
Seb could tell nothing from the expression on Bashara's face.
"How much did you pay for your shares, Mr. Clifton?"
"I've been purchasing Farthing stock regularly over the past 5 years, and the price has averaged out at around £2.
"Then it has proved a worthwhile investment, Mr. Clifton. Am I to assume you now wish to sell your shares?"
"No. Mr. Sloane has already made me an offer of £5 a share, which I turned down."
"But you would have made a handsome profit."
"Only in the short term."
"And if I were to offer you more?"
"It would be of no interest to me. I still intend to take my place on the board."
"Why?"
"Because I began my working life at Farthing's as Cedric Hardcastle's personal assistant. After his death, I resigned and joined Kaufman's."
"Shrewd old bugger, Saul Kaufman, and a smart operator. Why did you leave Farthing's?"
"Let's just say there was a difference of opinion over who should attend funerals."
"So Sloane wouldn't be happy if you were to join the board?"
"If murder was legal, I'd be dead."
Bashara took out his checkbook and asked,
"What's your favourite charity?"
That was one question Seb hadn't been prepared for.
"The Boy Scouts."
"Yes, I can believe that,"
said Bashara, smiling as he wrote out a cheque. Not for £100, but for £1,000.
"A pleasure to have met you, Mr. Clifton,"
he said, as he handed it over.
"I have a feeling we may meet again."
Seb shook his outstretched hand and was about to leave when Bashara added,
"What was the one thing in particular we have in common?"
"The oldest profession. Except in my case, it was my grandmother, not my mother."
"What's Sir Edward's opinion of your chances of winning the case?"
asked the Major as Virginia poured him a second gin and tonic.
"He's 100% certain we can't lose. Open and shut case," were his exact words, "and he's convinced the jury will award me substantial damages, possibly as much as 50,000.
"That's good news," said Fisher. "Will he be calling me as a witness?"
"No, he says he doesn't need you, although he thinks there's an outside chance the other side may call you, but it's unlikely.